Welcome to the Serious Eats Podcast, Special Sauce. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of our cultural fabric, food folks and non-food folks alike.
Great chefs, you know, they work in an ephemeral art form. And the fact that the ones who are so dedicated, committed, adventurous, inventive, will do this amazing thing with so much focus and care and love, knowing it's going to disappear. You know, I get to do a thing that's that isn't going to disappear in 5 minutes.
This week, it is my pleasure to welcome writer, director, producer, social media maven, and fellow podcaster Brian Koppelman. With his writing partner David Levine, he's written Rounders, Ocean's 13, Runaway Jury, among many other movies. Brian has also written and directed A Solitary Man, starring Michael Douglas, and an ESPN 30 for 30 documentary, This Is What They Want, about one of tennis great Jimmy Connors' classic matches. His podcast, The Moment, has hundreds of thousands of listeners. His Vine series of six-second screenwriting lessons has, what, Brian, like
60 million loops.
60 million loops. And currently he's shooting a new show for Showtime, Billions, starring Damian Lewis and Paul Giamatti. So welcome one of the 21st century's true Renaissance man, friend, neighbor, and serious eater, Brian Koppelman.
Oh, so happy to be here. I was going to say, you should have just said friend right at the beginning of this thing. Could have cut all that out. So this is my pal, Brian, and we're going to...
Exactly. So I know you grew up on Long Island. What was the food culture like in Roslyn? I know a little bit about the pizza culture, but I don't know about the overall food culture you grew up in.
I mean, it was a disaster. The food culture. First of all, I thought those things there was actually no connection between those two words. Where I grew up, culture was one thing, and food was the shit I was forced to eat. So let's be really clear about that just from the beginning. And by the way, back then, you know, my idea of culture was probably REO Speedwagon, so I didn't know anything about either, really. My mom was a good cook, meaning that she wasn't an imaginative or an experimental cook, but she cared enough to figure out how to cook what she cooked well.
Parents, not adventurous.
No, my parents weren't adventurous eaters. You know,
I've eaten with your dad.
My dad loves food, but he loves Italian food and traditional American Chinese food. Those right. are the things that
and
he...
And Italian-American food, like he, you know, like Rao's and that kind of thing.
Southern, I mean, he would describe as, I think, Southern Italian cuisine, you know. So we grew up, we would go to what was considered, you know, Don Pepe's Vesuvio's in Ozone Park, which was considered... like a great Southern Italian restaurant. And I still, to me, I can recognize and understand that heavy garlic marinara, so, you know, food that they serve. And I still love that stuff. But that was the height of
sure. And for people that don't know, Don Pepe's is a restaurant right next to Aqueduct Racetrack, where it's like right out of a movie. Because you just can't believe that this place exists. At least when I went for the first time in 2014, it could have been 1955.
So we would go a special treat on Sunday nights would be we would drive to Don Pepe's, and there was always a line. But my father was in the music business, and the owner of Don Pep's, I think it's long enough that this story is okay to tell. We would wait on the line and like everybody else. And then it turned out that the son of the owner wanted to become a dancer. And the guy came over to the table one day, and I think he said something to my dad like, you know, my son, he wants to become a dancer. What am I going to do with this? And my dad said, what do you want me to do? And he goes, could you tell him not to?
That's awesome.
And I think that I can't tell you exactly what happened, but I can tell you that we would enter Don Pepe's Goodfellas style through the kitchen and avoid the line every Sunday night after that.
I loved when I went to Don Pepe's. The greatest moment at Don Pepe's, the food was actually, a lot of it was really good, but I love the fact that at exactly 9 o'clock, the waiters, the entire staff, would play cards on a big round table. That was their way of telling you the kitchen is closed.
We're done for the night. We started to play canasta now.
I've never seen that anywhere else. There was this bizarre Italian card game, or was it canasta? I don't know.
I don't know what they were playing.
Yeah.
I don't know what they're looking for. But so, you know, and then I somehow in high school, I remember the first time I ate sushi, and that was the first time that I realized consciously, oh, food is this whole other, it can be this whole other thing. I really would have told you there were two cuisines that were worth eating. But, you know, you grow up in a house and that's what you're served. Even though my parents were of Jewish heritage, we didn't eat traditional Jewish food at all. My mother would cook basically simple Italian recipes a lot, or like pot American food.
Right, or right? Baked ziti.
Yeah, my dad cooked a lot of baked ziti. But that's what we – that's it. And when at a certain point – I remember in maybe ninth grade or something like that, having sushi just come into New York and having takoyaki. And I knew I'd like Japanese food because Rocky Aoki was on the show Wonderama right when Benihana opened, which was this morning show, Wonderama, that all the kids watch when television was regional.
With Sonny Fox.
Bob McAllister was my host. Okay. The host of my era was Bob McAllister. And because I'm younger than you by a little bit. And Rocky Aoki was on that show. And so then I remember everyone, all you wanted to do on your birthday was go to Benihana.
It was weird when I read something that I actually didn't know, and we've been friends for a long time, that you went to law school. Was that a mistake? Or did you go?
Was it a mistake to go?
Yeah.
Or was it a mistake that on my bio
actually,
or something?
In any way.
Yeah, I went to law school. I went to law school at night. I had read this book by Morris Dees, who started the Southern Poverty Law Center. And I was incredibly moved by that book and by his journey. And civil rights had always been really important to me. And I had this idea that I was going to go to law school and become a civil rights lawyer. And as soon as I got to law school, I realized, oh, this isn't the way that I'm going to affect change in my life. And this isn't exactly the right thing. But I found the pursuit really compelling. I was really interested in the mechanics and also the intellectual underpinnings of our legal system. And I love learning about constitutional law. And because I didn't care about how I did on the tests, I just knew I did well enough in law school to I pass and all that stuff. At a certain point, it was like, oh, this is really fascinating thing to do. And so I finished. But I knew I was never going to practice. It's ended up being invaluable in so many different ways. And I still read every Supreme Court decision, and I'm still really fascinated.
Let's fast forward. All these years, you're making billions, which involves the legal system. Like, was there a connection between the two things? Was that part of the inspiration or the context? Billions is a show that you're doing for Showtime right now.
Yeah, it's a show that will be on January 17th at 10 at night, and every Sunday night, for 12 episodes. Season one is 12 episodes, and we're about to start shooting the last episode of the first season. It stars Paul Giamatti and Damian Lewis, and it's about a hedge fund billionaire and the United States Attorney for the Southern District. Giamatti's the United States Attorney for the Southern District. Many of the movies have benefited from and shows from the fact that I have that background and from that interest. Look, I mean, everything that you do adds to the prism through which you see the world. So each thing that you do in life, I think, helps form your worldview and helps form, how you think things work and the things that you're interested in. It all stacks up. One thing stacks upon the next. And so, look, Rounders was about a guy who was going to law school and had to decide which dream he was going to chase and why. And we wrote that right in the shadow of me going to law school soon thereafter. And so, yeah, it's definitely connected. I mean, I've always been guided, as you have, actually, by curiosity and passion. And so I follow those things. If I'm curious about something and then I become obsessed, you can bet that that's what I'm going to concentrate on for the next couple of years. And I've lived that way pretty much my whole life.
Yes.
And so I'm thrilled that I chased that down. It turned out that wasn't a road I wanted to continue on, but it's definitely one I'm glad that I went down.
Yeah, and when I think about it, it's like every one of your movies, there's legal subtext, right?
There's
Ocean's 13, Runaway Jury. I didn't even think of that, but now, of course, it makes perfect sense. So let's talk about you. You just alluded to your creative process.
Yeah.
So you've worked in so many media, but I'm specifically thinking of television and movies. You have a writing partner who is your best friend.
For my whole life, yeah.
David Levine. Talk a little bit about your creative process as it relates to material you're drawn
sure.
to, stories you want to tell.
Yeah. I love thinking about this stuff. You know, for me, I always want to keep in mind and I always want to say, because I find that often people who listen to podcasts are people who really want to dive into something. And they're one thing that people write to me about on Twitter is they'll say, you know, I wish I could access the most creative part of myself. They're feeling stopped from doing it somehow. And so for me, I was 30 before I could. I was a blocked writer. And to me, that was a really painful place to be in. And so when I think about how I do any of this, I always go back to the fact that there was a time that I really couldn't as much as I wanted to. And I couldn't somehow. And I think a lot of us have something in us that we wish we could do and we find that we're blocked. And, you know, for me, I found that when that stuff was blocked, it felt toxic. And if you're that kind of toxicity spreads. And I realized I wanted to be able to be the best version of myself for my kids and my wife, and that I would only do that if I found a way to get through this. So my process starts with putting myself in a place where I'm open as I can to great ideas or ideas that I find myself passionate about. And so I do morning pages every day. I do three longhand pages every morning of my life.
And, really?
That comes out of Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way originally. And so I do that and I meditate and I take long walks. And those things, I think, point me toward being creative. That's what works for me. It's what I call like a creative practice that works for me. And often in doing the morning pages, something will show up after a few days, a month, or when I'm meditating, an idea will drop into my head, or when I'm taking a walk, I realize, oh, I'm thinking about this idea or this world that I'm interested in, or a question comes to mind. And by being open, by putting myself in a place that I'm ready to receive that stuff, I notice it. And so the start is sort of noticing a thing and then noticing how I feel about that thing.
Yeah. It's obviously about the subtext. It's all about the world that you find yourself thinking about.
Often it's a fascination. It's something that feels like I won't get bored doing it, that I'll want to chase down every day for a long period of time, and that somehow feels worthy of that kind of energy directed towards it. So first time I walked into a poker room, the world kind of exploded for me, and I realized I could spend years thinking about this and doing it. And it's that kind of feeling that you're looking for.
Right.
This show, Billions, I mean, Dave and I have been thinking about and making notes for and researching the world of hedge funds for 7 or 8 years before
Wow.
we wrote the pilot to that show.
I was doing research for pizza, my pizza book, ever since I was 10.
Right. Well, I was going to say, as have I, by the way. Yeah.
And so let's talk about pizza, because it is a passion of both of ours. And you actually contributed to my pizza book by dispensing some heretical, seemingly heretical information.
Well, heretical, especially, even though I recognized and I wrote in the article that I was speaking heresy, I don't even agree with my own point anymore. Or I do. The article, the essay in your book was a defense of what was then called gourmet pizza. I don't even think people use that term anymore. But at the time, gourmet pizza was, I guess, pizza that was sort of a fusion pizza. And I really like it. But now, even the best... Chris Bianco, Bianco Pizzeria. I mean, I love his pizza.
Famous pizzeria in Phoenix, Arizona.
And he certainly does like the traditional Neapolitan pizza. But he also does pizzas that aren't.
No.
And that would be classified as like gourmet pizza. I mean, this has now all come together. But when Una Pizza Napolitana had just opened or was just about to open when I wrote that piece. In fact, in your book, you talk all about Tony's place in New Jersey, and he hadn't yet come to the city. When I walked into that place, it did spin. For a year, all I wanted to eat was that pizza. I mean, I would go to that place constantly, and it did recalibrate what my expectations were. And I think he changed the way people thought about a certain kind
of
pizza.
Right, and then Tony opened Una Pizza Napolitana in New York, then just picked up, moved to San Francisco, and moved it there. And for those people who don't know, Anthony Mongeri is such a purist that he doesn't even have salads on his menu. You know, and he doesn't have – for a while, he just had beverages and pizza, and then people got mad because he wouldn't serve them water.
Four pizzas, right? Filete di pomodoro.
The white pizza.
The white pizza. The margarita.
And that was it.
And I still remember what each of those tastes like. And I haven't had them in years. I haven't been to the – the one – I was in San Francisco a day that it was closed. Pizza is, sadly, one of my favorite things in the world. I say sadly because no matter what diet I'm on, it's the thing that ends up fucking my diet up.
Well, I know the second thing that screws your diet up, because we've talked about this too, because it always screws my diet up, ramen. I mean, you were a ramen freak even before I was.
Yeah, I'm nuts for it. Yeah, it's true. And, you know, that's not obviously not something I was eating as a kid, but... Once I had – the reason I was mentioning that sushi sort of blew my mind is that once I had sushi, I then was on an exploration. And starting in college, I mean, I would eat – there's no – you know, I love Ethiopian food and Indian food and traditional Thai food. And ramen, especially the way ramen is thought about now, it combines – it's sort of a great state-of-the-art delivery system for the highest level – food for regular people that there is.
I like that description.
And, you know, it has everything that you want. It's got umami, and sometimes it's got sweet elements, and it's got spicy elements, and there's something to chew on and something to slurp. I mean, it's kind of perfect. And,
and meaty and porky if you want.
New York has really become a ramen town also.
Yes.
You can get great ramen. Look, we both love Ivan Orkin's places, Ivan Ramen, and he's my friend, and I became friends with him because of how much I love the soup. I mean, I decided, look, this guy makes such great fucking soup. I better become his pal so I can go whenever I want. But there are great places for all different kinds. I mean, it's amazing. You can get skeimen if you want, and then you can go get tonkatsu at certain places. And there, it's amazing in the variety. It's not quite Tokyo, but you can, you know, whatever your ramen hankering is in Manhattan now, you can go get it.
Yes. No, and I think what's interesting is you actually bring up the fact that you loved Ivan Orkin's ramen so much that you became friends with. And that's sort of something that you've done a lot with chefs that you love. And I think it's so interesting because it's almost like part of a creative process in a way.
Well, yeah, it doesn't happen. I mean, I said it in a funny way just now, but as you know, the great thing about chefs is if you're pals with one chef who thinks that you're there for the right reasons, meaning that you get what they do, you really get it, like you really dig what they do kind of on their terms, you're honest with them, you're really engaging about it. They can give you a dish and you'll answer honestly. You're not kissing their ass, but you're not coming from some place where you're just looking to cut them off at the knees, they'll share you around and introduce you to their chef friends.
Because, yes, that's true.
And so I was a very early, you know, you and I went to Mamafuku together at the very beginning. Like the place had been open 3 months. And
right,
we went,
David Chang's first restaurant.
We went to Noodle Bar together. The two of us and our sons went very, very, very early in the thing. And out of that, you know, I became pals with David. I became pals with David Chang just because I would go there all the time. And he, in the beginning, chefs, if you support a place early, they recognize it. And so through David, when Ivan was opening in New York, through David I met Chris Ying, who runs
Lucky Peach.
Lucky Peach. And Ying wrote Ivan's book with him and then put me together with Ivan when Ivan was coming to New York, and we just hit it off.
Right.
And I do love talking to chefs because I love the fact that they make great chefs, you know, they're working, as they've said, I'm not saying anything new here, but they're working in ephemeral art form. And the fact that the ones who are so dedicated, committed, adventurous, inventive, and will do this amazing thing with so much focus and care and love, knowing it's going to disappear. you know, I get to do a thing that's that isn't going to disappear in 5 minutes. So the focus that I deploy is going to be rewarded for me in that, you know, last night one of my movies was on television and I got to see it years later. For 5 minutes, Rounders was on. I got to watch it for 5 minutes, and because I hadn't seen it probably in 10 years, and what a great sort of like a gift for me to be able to see the stuff I would change now, the stuff I wouldn't. What I remembered where I was standing, how young Matt looked, so how young I was, but chefs don't get to have that experience. They're giving you everything for your pleasure in this instant.
Right. They're a little bit like stage actors that way.
And so I love them. I just admire that what it takes. I mean, there are so many chefs I admire who I don't know. You know, I was thinking about Gabrielle Hamilton the other day.
From the owner of Prune.
Prune and her incredible book, Blood, Bones, and
Blood, Bones
and Butter, right?
Yeah.
But I was thinking about her and you know, by her own admission in her own book, she's a controversial figure. But the way that she's able to think about, talk about, cooking an eggplant is amazing to me. I'm completely fascinated by how somebody can touch an eggplant as it's cooking on the burner without a pan and know what it's going to taste like and what to add to it and how to blow your mind with it.
Right. You see, I've always had this theory about you that you're looking in many ways at a mirror image of your own process.
Yeah, I don't think about it that way, but sure. Yeah. No, I'm sure that I am. I've always just been really attracted to and engaged by great artists in any area, or people who have a super high level of enthusiasm and commitment to what they do.
Yeah.
Because, right, I'm blown away by athletes also who can do that. And anytime I meet somebody who does the thing that they do with full-on passion, commitment, and plays incredibly hard at it,
you're there.
Interested.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, sure. Let's talk a little bit about the whole idea of voice and chefs having voices, right? Chefs, the great chefs have really, really distinctive voices, right? The same way great writers and great directors and screenwriters, you know, Chang has a voice, Mario Batali has an unmistakable voice. And it's one of those things, voice, the way I define it, is like for a writer, it's like you know in the first sentence who wrote it.
Sure.
You know, and like when you taste certain chef's food, oh, that's, you know, that's a Thomas Keller dish, and you just have that feeling. So how did you develop your voice, and how would you describe it?
I think about voice a lot. I get asked about it a lot. Writers ask me how to develop it. I mean, voice is an end result of all the other work, isn't it? It's an end result of all the stuff we've been talking about. Because you're, as I said, if you're developing this prism, then that's the voice. All the stuff that you've watched, listened to, eaten, thought about, the thing you want to say goes through that. And then what comes out is your point of view, right? Because voice is another way to express point of view. And that's what you're talking about with chefs, too. You're talking about the way that they see the world expressed through their art, through their food.
It's the sum total of their life's experience and your life's experience.
I mean, you mentioned Mario, and he's definitely the chef I've spent the most time with. He's a good friend and somebody I love. And look, everything Mario does—
This is Mario Batali.
Yeah, everything Mario does, all across every part of this gigantic world that he touches, has a unified voice.
Yes.
And you can bring it all back to Poe and Molto Mario, too, to the beginning of the way he wanted to reshape how we think about Italian food. And to me, every part of what he does has this incredible voice. It's harder for me to talk about my own, other than I do know that when Dave and I, the final product that Dave and I produce, if you look at all the stuff, it's unified. There is a unified tone. There's something about it. If you care about our stuff or if you're into it, you'd be able to recognize it. But the things that exactly make that the case, that's harder for me to diagnose. It's not even something I want to think about.
You know, for me, when I think about all your work, and I do want to ask about how the voice pervades every medium that you work in. But to me, it's like your voice is a lot about the constant battle between good and evil that exists in every situation. You know, it's like, and all the gray areas that exist in between. You know, I mean, if you think about Rounders, like Rounders was that way.
I don't really see the world as a Manichaean construct where it's just black and white, good and evil. But I do think that there's the struggle to be our best selves. And
yeah, and that's what I mean.
I do think that there's a struggle to figure out what your best self is and then to live that. Mm-hmm. And I am absolutely find that really animating, you know, and I'm sure that that's pervasive and stuff think about. And my podcast about that too, right? It's about how people were able to unlock the moment where their best self showed up and whether they were able to chase that down and live up to that. And I think that that's certainly the gauntlet I try to throw for myself and then, you know, follow. And I don't know if it's possible.
And I'm sure if you ever did look back or when you're creating billions, there's that element of even for billionaires, I guess, you know, I mean.
Well, that's a real question for me about, you know, the thing there that was the question that Dave and I kept trying to ask ourselves and still I'm trying to understand is what's inside of someone that makes them unable to stop at what most of us would define as enormous financial success.
Right.
Why can somebody make $10 million and think, oh, this is great, I can play golf the rest of my life, or I can be philanthropic for the rest of my life, or I can do whatever, I can go to the great, you know, go down the 50 greatest restaurants list. And then why does somebody else see the $10 million as not even a start?
Not even a start.
And what is that motor? And that is, I look at the world that we live in now, and I don't, it's, you know, look, I find the world very hard to understand sometimes. You know, I see somebody like Trump saying the stuff that he says, and I don't, it's very hard for me to understand. So I want to understand it, and I try to figure that stuff out in what I do.
Yeah. When you're trying to figure it out and you're working with David, do you often find yourselves in opposite camps?
Sometimes. I mean, sometimes we find ourselves in opposite camps only in, I got to say, in the most micro level. I mean, we have a completely unified, we grew up together, we have all the same shared interests. We may see a very particular political issue slightly differently, but to the outside, it would seem like we saw it exactly the same way. But none of the stuff is polemical, and it's always about like then finding a story that animates the question, right? The story has to still be interesting, compelling, fun.
You embraced the internet really early. People thought I was insane, of course, when I started Serious Eats in 2006, too.
Yeah.
So I can remember Jeffrey starting out and going, you're not going to do your stories for the New York Times anymore? Have you lost your mind?
That's funny.
But and both were true. I had lost my mind, and I wasn't going to do the story stories for the New York Times. But what's amazing to me—
I got to say, it was really fun when you were doing those stories, because before you had Serious Eats, the results of whatever you were going after would just show up in our apartment building, and then I would be the beneficiary and my kids would be the beneficiary. So when you were doing the bagel test, suddenly we had bagels, and when you were doing a barbecue test, we'd have barbecue.
Yes, this is
and
true.
And I must say, I do miss those days. That was really great.
They'll be back.
Yeah. Now it's all at the Serious Eats office. They all have that stuff.
So what about the internet? Why did you embrace it so wholeheartedly?
Because I don't see it as separate from the corporeal world, man. It's one world. I don't see internet culture and culture as a separate thing. I don't know. How do you remain a connected artist and not connect to where people are expressing themselves in a way the most freely? And so right away I thought, oh, well, people are gathering here and they're saying what they're thinking about and they're linking to the things that they're really interested in, and I can engage with them somehow. And so I would say it was instinctive. I just I didn't want to be on the outside of it. I wanted to be on the inside of it. We could all walk out of here and we could get hit by a bus, but actuarially we live longer, right? And I don't want to be one of those people who doesn't understand what the kids are talking about. And I don't think it would serve what I do to be somebody who doesn't understand it. I feel like you can tell instantly if somebody's like a native Twitter user or somebody who's come to Twitter because they think it's what they're supposed to do.
Well,
I'm a native Twitter user.
What's funny is it's so interesting that that's the way you describe the internet, because for me, it's why I started Serious Eats. It's because for two reasons. Number one, when I would write books or articles, people would write me letters, but I knew it was a tiny fraction of the people whose lives I had affected in some way. So the internet, where you get this instant feedback, is one of the greatest things ever. And the other thing for me, which was probably less of a problem for you, is the internet takes away all the gatekeepers.
Yeah,
in your life,
of course.
Which is a beautiful thing.
No, it's great. And look. I think one of the differences between people who seem like native users and not is I'm as close to uncensored as I can possibly be on Twitter. Meaning I made the decision that there would be very little difference between who I am in the public persona and in my actual persona. Certainly, like on my podcast, I'm probably the best version of who I'm probably not exactly as understanding in real life. And I don't probably the most, in a certain way, empathetic version as I'm listening to somebody's story. I mean, my kids see that side of me, obviously. But basically, I'm who I am, and I don't try to calculate or calibrate the version of me that shows up online.
It's not sanitized. It's not
filtered. It's not. So that, and I think that by doing that, that's part of why I have a community of people with whom I interact online.
Mm-hmm. And which obviously leads me to the series of Vine videos you did.
Sure.
I mean, how did those come about? And
I can't stand con artists, you know, and I'm fascinated by con artists, but I can't stand them. And there are anytime there, you know, people are so aspirational to get into Hollywood that they fall for bunco artists who claim to be screenwriting teachers. And
I like that.
I got very frustrated by I'd be on Twitter sometimes and I would do Twitter Q&A. So I'd say, hey, it's Sunday morning. I'll spend 20 minutes answering questions. And some of the questions would have an underlying premise that I didn't understand. It wasn't an underlying premise that working screenwriters would recognize. It was clear that they had been told by someone, oh, you have to write in this genre. So the question would be, you know, if you've decided you're only going to write mysteries in the youth market, and I'd be like, where are you getting this? And it would be, oh, well, I went to a crime writing seminar at the Radisson in, you know, Louis Obispo or something. And in a moment of pique, I just looked in. I had like 6 Vine followers at the time or something, but I it was linked to my Twitter, and I looked at my phone and I said, all screenwriting books are bullshit, all of them. Read screenplays, watch movies, and let those be your guide. And as a joke, I called it 6 seconds, really to entertain my son, I called it 6 second screenwriting lessons number one. And I posted it, and I uploaded it, and then I just went to work. And by the time I got to my office, a bunch of actors and directors had retweeted it because it was linked, had retweeted it, and were all saying like, oh, we're so happy somebody said this. And I just decided I would do one of them a day until I had nothing more to say that I felt was true and important. And I did 340 of them or something.
So give us an example. Give us 2 examples of those.
Someone should just go to Vine and look up 6 second screenwriting lessons. I don't even I don't carry them around with me. You know, they're 6 seconds, basically. It's a sentence about...
So give us one sentence.
Well, one would be, you know, write what you know is fine, but more important, I think, is to write your obsessions, write what fascinates you. And so it would be things like that or things about unlocking creativity or not listening to gatekeepers, not being knocked down by gatekeepers, kept out, not believing them.
Got it. So... Billions is a show about greed. A lot of people relate greed to gluttony. Did you find when you looked into that world that there was a relationship between the two? Like, how did you handle that?
Well, I'll say Wall Street's about greed. I don't know that I've ever said Billions is about greed.
Right.
I think I reject the premise. But it's a lot more complicated than that. It's about need ambition and power. But look, I understand the question about gluttony. When you talk to these people, you learn what they're really interested in is access, is connection, is living an unfettered existence. I mean, a lot of the hedge fund billionaires are thin and work out all the time, and then some are corpulent. But food, the way people express themselves in food is completely on display in the show, because the show takes place in New York City. And so some people have chefs who prepare it takes place in New York City and in Westport, Connecticut. And some people have chefs who prepare super healthy meals for them all the time. And some characters are constantly finding an out-of-the-way Asian place that serves some weird thing that they can eat. But one thing from the beginning that Dave and I told our actors is that in our show, when actors eat, they really eat. And so we have people... When we showcase it, we have a great moment where some people brought in Ethiopian food, and you see the injera, and you see the Ethiopian food, and it's we are absolutely interested in the way people engage with food, and that definitely shows up. When someone grabs a reporter and takes them for banh mi, there'll be a little second where they'll talk about why someone won't eat the bread and will only eat like the cabbage salad. So that stuff's absolutely in the show.
That's great. That's great.
And on the private plane that Damian Lewis's character is on, you will definitely see sambar represented and samsauce.
That's great. Awesome. All right. Now it's the time for the express buffet.
Sure.
So who would be at your last supper?
This is going to bore. It's a boring answer, man, because it's my family. No question about it. My wife and my children and my parents, sisters.
I know, but I think it is. You think people would say that? People do say that, but it's also families are very complicated.
They are, but look, I'm a lucky person for a variety of reasons, but paramount is because I married the right person at a young age, and I think if you get married as young as we did. Amy and I got married at 25. She was younger. I don't think I knew enough to make that decision in a smart way. I lucked into it. And so my wife's a great novelist and screenwriter, and our kids are terrific and really smart, interesting people. That's who I would pick in the world.
If you could have dinner with one person, living or dead?
Yeah, that's a great question. Sure.
And it can't be family member. Who would it be? This isn't Jeopardy. You got plenty of time here.
It's not just the person, right? It's the person at what period in their lives. I mean, the screenwriter in me would say David Mamet in 1988, the day that he finished writing Speed the Plow.
Speed the Plow, where there's that famous line about the movie business. There's only two things I've learned about the movie business. There's no such thing as gross, and I can't remember the other.
If it's not art and it's not commerce, it's on my desk. I keep a copy of Speed the Plow, Dave and I do, on our desk. And when we're having a really bad Hollywood day, one of us will just pick it up and start open to any page and start.
That's awesome.
Just start reading it, But look. I'd love to have dinner with Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, and eat whatever he shot that day. I'd be happy to go eat with him. I mean, that'd be incredible.
That'd be incredible.
So there's so many different ways you can answer that question. Now, Bob Dylan, right when he came back from the British tour from Don't Look Back, right? I mean, the truth is, if I could have dinner with somebody now and it would just be the two of us at a table, somebody alive, I think it would be Michael Stipe. That's who I would have.
Really? Michael Stipe from REM would be the person you'd...
If I had to answer just this second right now... I'm going to have another person at the table. And Haruki Murakami. Those people. The novelist, who's my favorite living novelist. And all right, I'll give you one more for the full Last Supper, which is you know, David Foster Wallace,
Infinite Jest,
a year before, you know, maybe the day he stopped taking his medicine, so I could tell him to please start taking it again.
That would be a fascinating dinner. And what restaurant would it be at?
I would go to Babbo. There's no better place. You know, I've had dinners with Salman Rushdie at Babbo, which is as close to that as it could possibly, as you could get. And that environment was built. You know, the first floor, banquette, you walk in, the banquette, either right on the left or just on the right. I can't imagine a better place in the world than sitting there with Salman, and maybe Mario comes walking in and pours a little wine for you as he sits down and joins you at the table. That's not a bad night. That's a pretty good night, right?
I think that's a pretty swell night. So, all right, one more food-related question, and that is, what's in your desert island fridge?
Oh, I have such a really un-PC answer to that. But definitely, I mean, my favorite food of all still is perfectly prepared sushi, probably. It's just I wouldn't go to a sushi restaurant with David Foster Wallace because the meal would be over too quickly, right? The best sushi places are going to get you out of there in 27 minutes.
Right.
So I would have, you know, sushi grade, you know, just the top flight uni. And the bad answer is really perfect foie gras that I could sear with brandy if I knew how to do it.
Okay.
But this is my desert island. There's no moral component to the desert island.
And there's no limits. So it's desert
fridge.
Island.
So, I mean, those things would certainly be in there. And, you know, maybe a leftover pork bun from David Chang.
Would you do us a favor and make us a movie about the Trump run for president?
Yeah, man. I mean, Bullworth is the best political movie the last few years. And Advising Consent is a movie everybody should see right now. Advising Consent, Otto Preminger's movie from the 50s, is an incredible movie about how corrupt that world really is and the value of demagoguery in terms of... of all the stuff that's going on now. No, look, it's funny. I have people I know who know him well and like him, but Trump, but I find his rhetoric to be despotic and
toxic.
And I don't recognize the country that I don't recognize living in a country where 30% of the people are in line with what he has to say.
So it sounds like the movie's been done, that if people watch Advice and Consent, it's probably as relevant now as it is.
Advice and Consent is really worth watching. It's not exactly about a Trump-like figure, but it is about the way in which the public opinion and personal ambition skew the process.
Got it. Well, thank you. This is a gas. You know, to talk to a friend, a neighbor, and a fellow serious eater.
Awesome.
You know, it's been – so thank you for sharing your special sauce with us, Brian. Check out Brian's podcast, The Moment, Stream Rounders on Netflix. It's a movie that has stood the test of time because I have watched it recently.
Oh, thanks, Ed. Hey, man, let me just say I'm so happy you're doing this because the more people get to hear your things filtered through your own prism, the better. You know, you have introduced me to – an entirely new way to look at food and the world, and I'm really grateful for it and happy to be here and to have the benefit of getting to do this with you anytime that I want.
Oh, well, that's great. Good. And now you just guaranteed more ribs at your door.
Awesome.
So also, of course, we're all looking forward to watching Billions on Showtime.
January 17th, 10 p.m. Tune in that first night.
I can't wait. And you have the greatest line is in the first promo I saw.
It's in the pilot. That line is in the pilot.
What's the good of having fuck you money if you never get to say fuck you?
Sure. Absolutely.
I mean, that may be, you know, that could be on your gravestone. You know, it's so powerful and so memorable.
You know what? By that time, I'll be nothing, so I won't care.
So long, everyone. See you next time on Special Sauce.
Thanks, Ed. This was great.